So welcome to our day of recollection, our Lenten day of reflection. My intention is to give two presentations this morning with time not only for our own feedback, but also for quiet time, where you can go out and sit on one of the benches, just push the snow off the bench and sit. I'm going to stick to the Bible in one sense, or should say start with the Bible, but try to make these connections for Lent as well. Some of you are familiar with this book of mine called Street Wisdom, Connecting with God in Everyday Life. And the thesis of this book is the contrast between what I call mastery and intimacy. And I need to hear this again. So I'm going to read the introduction to the book. If you want to listen in, it might help. Think twice before tossing that empty bottle over the side the next time you go boating at the seashore. A discarded bottle lying in the ocean bottom is, it seems, an irresistible temptation for a baby crab. The little creature, about the size of your thumbnail, glides easily through the bottle's mouth to discover an enclosed world that offers everything it needs. Plenty of organic debris to eat, shelter from the strong currents, and best of all, protection from the countless predators who feed on young crabs. Delighted, it makes itself at home and begins to thrive in the cozy surroundings. After some weeks, however, when instinct tells it the time has come to migrate, it crawls confidently to the opening, expecting to swim back out the way it came in. That's when it discovers the ghastly price of that time of perfect security. It has grown too big to fit through the neck of the bottle. In a terrible, ironic twist, that safe shelter now becomes a death chamber. Its protective shield will be its coffin. In every human being, there's a tension between the lure of the safe and certain on the one hand and the challenge of the unknown and risky on the other. Our lives are shaped by the ebb and flow of the struggle between these two forces inside us. In the book, I call them mastery and intimacy. Although these words have commonly accepted meanings, I use each of them in a wider sense, contrasting them with one another. Here are just a few of the main differences between the two. Mastery is the approach to life in which I impose my will on situations and on people, using my power to make things happen just the way I want. Intimacy, on the other hand, means the willingness to deal with what is given, without having to change every situation to suit me or to fix what's wrong with every person I meet. Mastery is the part of me that prizes predictability. Mastery hates mystery, because to call something a mystery is to admit that I can't control it. Intimacy, on the other hand, is my instinctive sense that anything worthwhile involves uncertainty and risk. That's what prompts me to tell someone I love you, even though there's the chance that he or she will laugh in my face. Mastery knows only that narrow external world where I evaluate myself and others in terms of clear, measurable standards. Intimacy, however, finds the ultimate meaning of my life in the realm of inner reality, infinitely beyond all my measuring, comparing, and competing. Mastery is all about me. I use my power and my talents to accomplish my tasks and achieve my goals. Intimacy, by definition, is about us and involves me in the needs and wants of someone else. Real happiness, according to this approach, comes from relating to and connecting with others rather than from being absorbed with myself first. When developmental psychologists describe normal psychological growth as a process of passing by stages from the self-centeredness of the infant to the cheerful self-giving of the adult, they are saying that psychological maturation is the movement from mastery to intimacy. The dynamic interplay of intimacy and mastery is the main plot of the Bible. God, who is passionately in love with the people of the covenant, keeps inviting them to risk everything and rely on Yahweh alone. But the chosen people keep refusing the invitation to divine intimacy and look for control and security instead in idols, armies, alliances. When the Word takes flesh in God's ultimate act of self-revelation, God lays bare the deepest mystery of the Godhead. God is love. This is the underlying theme of this book. Since we are made in the image of God, who is love, then our happiness, our freedom, and our very meaning must lie not in power or self-gratification, but self-sacrificing love, in intimacy with God and neighbor. So that's what we need to... That's the vocabulary that I'd like to deal with during this first discussion. We could just pass those sheets around. Thank you. I read pages 1 to 3, and I'm giving you a Xerox copy of pages 4 and 5. I own the copyright, you'll be happy to know. So I can do anything I want. You can't. You can't put this online and start selling it. Please. I would direct your attention to the scale on the right. You can see the two columns, mastery and intimacy, and if you read down the left-hand column, mastery column, you'll see things that are characteristic of mastery. And I just used several different situations. And it's not an on-off switch. It's this sort of continuum scale from one end to the other. And I thought it would be good just to read through these. Okay? First one. Wiz, would you start us off? You read the one on the left and then the one on the right, if you wouldn't mind.
Control and power. I need to make things and people into what I want them to be. The gentle approach. I accept and work with things and people as they are.
And it varies. When I was field testing this theory up in a parish in Dumont, there was a guy there who was a commercial airplane pilot. And he says, I'm not interested in relating to the co-pilot. You know, I don't have time for that up there. So he better have his mastery approach pretty much in hand while he's landing a 747. The gentle approach is the idea that I can deal with whatever is going on. So I get behind the hay wagon on the one-lane farm road, and I can't do it. I can beat my horn, scream, yell, nothing I can do about it. So why not just enjoy the sunflowers on the side of the road? The gentle approach is to accept what I can't change. So in varying situations, say with a spouse or with my students, with co-workers, with the abbot, where am I on this? You know, can I just accept, like, in obedience, can I just simply accept what's given, or do I feel that I need to push back a lot? Somebody like to read me the second one? Mateo?
I demand perfection from myself and others. I want conformity, and I don't like to make exceptions. I'm okay with imperfections, including my own. I'm comfortable with individual people's differences.
You can see how that varies. St. Benedict in the Rule says the abbot has to accustom himself and adjust himself to a variety of characters. He didn't know what he was saying. How true, the variety of characters in the monastery. And I discovered personally that once I stopped demanding perfection from myself, then I stopped demanding it of other people too. I became at least somewhat more patient with other people's foibles, because I realized I also realize that people love me not because I'm perfect. And in fact, you know from your own experience that it's the imperfections that make us more lovable most of the time.
Be perfect for your, or for that is perfect.
Yeah, it's appropriate.
Something else.
Yeah. Father Phil was onto something at the end this morning in the homily when he said, you know, when it says be perfect, I'm not sure about that. Well, if you get the New Jerusalem Bible translation, they hit the nail on the head. Exactly what that word teleos in Greek means there. The preceding sentence says, God lets the rain fall on the just and the unjust. The sun shines on the just and the unjust equally. Doesn't make any distinctions. If you love only the people that love you, what good is that? So now, you should be teleos. Here's what the New Jerusalem Bible translation says. It says, you should put no boundaries on your love, the same way God puts no boundaries on his love. The scholars tell us that teleos, which comes from the root for a goal, an end, well, God's end, they would say it all this involved, is justice. And it has to do with God's loving justice. So when God is being truly God, he loves everybody. And you should be that way too. You should put no boundaries on your love, the same way God puts none on his love. And I think that that comes into play on this scale at times, you know. I will love you as long as you fit my criteria of lovability. Okay. Who's got a third one for me? Third one now? Thanks.
I require lots of predictability in order to be comfortable, or I tend towards spontaneity and enjoy being surprised.
Does that vary with circumstances too? If you're working on an assembly line and you're putting this thing on these things as they come along and all of a sudden a purple rabbit comes down, that's a surprise, but not always a welcome one. Or you turn your computer on and expect it to boot up. Surprise, it doesn't. Oh, what a pleasant variation. So, in varying situations, do I always require predictability? I want to know what Father Albert is going to talk about in the afternoon conference. So do I. But that's... Think about any of these in varying situations. Could we get a next reader? Somebody pass it around here. Any other readers?
I put a high value on self-protection and security. I tend towards secrecy and closedness. Now, this is, I'm able to leave myself vulnerable, and I'm willing to take risks. I tend towards self-disclosure and openness.
Thank you. A high value on self-protection, security, secrecy, and closeness. Does Macy's tell Gimbel's? When you're in various competitive situations like that. Closeness and secrecy. But then we have a saying in the counseling department in the school, you're only as sick as your secrets. And it seems almost every day, and Max can attest to this, every day we're discovering some other poor kid walking around with stuff in his heart that would curl your hair, you know, and the closeness and the secrecy piece of it. I'm able to leave myself vulnerable, to share who I am, to self-disclosure and openness, take risks when appropriate. The next one. My wants, my needs. So with the current epidemic of cell phones with kids, that we'll be in the middle of a prayer. Mm-hmm. And kids have their cell phones. Mm-hmm. And not only the kids sometimes too. Mm-hmm. can't help it. We had a Syrian bishop talking to the kids the other day in the auditorium about what it's like over there and Christians being persecuted and killed and all this sort of stuff. And you know what I'm talking about. More, you see more of it than I do. On my wants and my needs, my ability to put my, to put the group's needs in front of mine, it seems to me, I don't know whether mastery intimacy works there or not, and selfishness versus sharing or something would certainly fit in that category. Mr. Boniface, could you do the second one from the bottom?
I am, that one?
Mm-hmm.
I am for effectiveness and efficiency. I am for nurturing and beauty.
If you go over to the classrooms in what we used to call the new building, the 1958 building, the walls have glazed tile up to about here, and then painted cinder block. And then they used to have light fixtures hanging down from the concrete ceiling with bare neon bulbs. Extremely efficient, extremely effective. Nobody ever asked, is this beautiful? Nobody ever says, is this a nurturing environment for kids? No, it's boy-proof. Yeah. So when do I use that criteria? Is what I am doing or planning to do effective and efficient? Yep. In our political situation right now, we have many discussions like that. Lots of economists are thrilled with what the president is doing. Thrilled. They think he's on the right track. He's meeting every day. The Times doesn't tell us all these things, you know, how busy the president is meeting with leaders, Democrats, Republicans, industrial leaders, and so on. And the economists are thrilled with this because it's effective and efficient. And they're in their little thing about, yeah, this would be great for gross economic output and that sort of stuff. But then what it does to people's hearts and souls and lives, well, that's not one of the criteria that we use. What about your own self? Effectiveness, I have to confess here too that I hope I've reformed a lot on that. Where I would be so busy, you know, on the railroad tracks, that if somebody were to dare to come along and say, excuse me, boom, and just get run over on the tracks. Sorry, I'm busy. Nurturing and beauty. And finally, I'll read this one. I rely on the rational. I live in my head. I mistrust or dismiss emotions. That would be the one extreme. The other extreme, I rely on my feelings, I rely on my heart, I respect and value emotions. I guess we all know people who are much more comfortable, their starting point is in their head, the rational approach. And other people who are all feeling, all heart, and think of various places where it's appropriate or inappropriate. You're a mom. And your five-year-old comes up and says, Ma, look what I did. And there's blood all over his hand, you know. And you go, oh, my God, you poor thing. You know, what are you going to do about this? No, what you need to do, depending on what's going on here, is death, dial 911 or whatever you dial, 41. Okay. Total emotion, I don't know whether that's ever a great thing, you know, because we are people who are made up of both the affective and the intellect part. But you can see when you go to extremes on these, lots of times you get yourself in trouble. But I'd be interested in some comments on this before we go on. Brother Max.
Yeah, one of the kind of most influential people in my life is Father John Blanchard, who's the headmaster of the school, high school I went to. He would repeat, you know, almost daily, would talk about becoming masters of themselves, self-mastery. And what's interesting is he used mastery in a different way. Like, he talked about these two qualities, and the left column would be control, and the right column would be surrender or acceptance. And so he used mastery in a positive sense. So, for example, self-mastery is where we master control our proclivity to control. I mean, to exercise our control over the people that narcissistic need to control. So we put that at bay so that we can be more accepting of other people. But also, what his emphasis on self-mastery, there has to be a positive, a center of internal control where you can exercise obedience. That was a big thing, obedience. Mm-hmm. That's the roots of my Benedictine vocation. Well, it started at home, but you know, the importance of obedience, which led to humility. But there's that locus of control, inner control, where you have a certain mastery over these inclinations that prevent you from being obedient to the will of God. Not yep. obedient to your fears, but especially obedient to the will of God. So he used mastery in a more positive sense. But he was talking about the basic two
categories. Yep, I like that control bit. You're talking, after all, to the novice master and the choir master, who used to teach from the book called French for Mastery. You know, so you're trying to master whether it's driving or master your tennis serve. And so that's Max pointing up that mastery, I'm just using it in a sense that I decided to use in that way. I would like now to ask you to turn the page over and use your Bibles. The first passage, Luke chapter 12. Gird your loins and light your lamps, and be like servants who await their master's return from a wedding, ready to open immediately when he comes and knocks. Blessed are those servants whom the master finds vigilant on his arrival. Amen, I say to you, he will gird himself and have them recline at table and proceed to wait on them. What if I'm so intent on being in control, to use Max's word there, to be in control, I'm only comfortable when I'm the doer. But Jesus says, no, just sit down and relax. I want to serve you. Anyone who thinks that being a follower of Christ means doing things for God is in for a bad shock eventually. That Jesus is saying, when you get to heaven, in this little parable anyway, the image is, God's going to wait on you. And you say, oh, no, I don't do that. I'm a server. I'm a waiter. That's what I do. Some of us have been caught in role reversal things. You know, the first time as an adult where a nurse had to lift my heel and lift the leg out of bed after the operation. And if she had dropped it a half an inch, I would have screamed in pain. But that was a role reversal for me because I'm a helper. I'm a professional helper as a teacher, as a clergyman. That's what we do. We help people. And God says, no, I'll help you. I want to wash your feet. Interesting, it seems to me that, I don't know, what's Jesus saying to us there, other than that? He will proceed to wait on you. Is he telling us that we need to develop that side of ourselves that lets us accept? Yeah, maybe. Lets us accept help from other people? Because I know some people very well who can't ask for help. I don't know whether it was growing up in the family I grew up in or something. I don't think I've ever had trouble, not much anyway, asking for help. So around here, especially if school is in session, I'm going to carry all these books up to the fourth floor like heck. Come here, give me three guys. But I know people who won't do that. And of course, we all know that principle. If you want it done right, maybe that's another intimacy mastery thing. I want it done right. So I'll do all these things myself. I'll go to bed totally exhausted because I had to do everything myself, but at least it got done perfectly. And I now have the personality of a train wreck, and everybody else has to suffer because of it. Let's try the next one, Mark. Mark chapter 10. Sure.
Helping out the people, getting yourself to serve them. I find it, it has happened to me many times, you know, and when I try to be, you know, when I try to offer little things to people, people who are like bigger than me and everything.
Right.
And they tend to say, oh, no, Boniface, well, I'm fine, you know? And it happened a lot of times, you know. I kind of feel, what's wrong with taking what I'm giving you? I mean, it's like, I'm not good enough, you know. Like, it should be always from him or from her, because she's maybe bigger than me and everything, and therefore, I shouldn't be giving, offering anything to them.
Yeah, without getting into too much sociology, because I'm not sure where you're coming from exactly, but we've all had that experience, I think, of offering service to someone, let me help you with that. And the person says, no, no, that's all right, I got it. And you want to say, you know what? I'm offering to help you. Have you ever had the experience of somebody offers to help you and you don't really need the help, but you say yes? Right? I think that's what I thought of with you, where you say, you know, I want to serve you, I want to help you, and the person, oh, thank you very much. Under their breath, they're saying, I don't really need this, but you need it. And someday, the Lord's going to ask you, when were you of service to people? And you're going to say, never, because nobody ever said yes. You know, whose feet did you wash? Nobody's. Nobody would let me wash their feet. I was at a marriage encounter weekend once down in Clark on the parkway. There was a, you know, right on parkway at that exit is a motel. So had this marriage encounter weekend, and I was just there as an observer. They liked to have priests there too. And when it was over, I was saying to the priest who had run the thing, okay, now I'll just make a call back to the monastery and get somebody to come and pick me up. And he looked at me. He said, why on earth would you do that? So you got 35 couples here who are all sky high with this whole business about love and service and all. Why wouldn't you give somebody a chance to love you? And then he turns and says, anybody going past Newark? Father Al needs a ride. All these people wanted to be of help. And the people who end up taking me had to go way out of their way. See? I should have said, no, 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 I will call, I'll get a cab.
I had done the work when I got sick and I had to go for therapy. to not be doing, trying to help you be self-sufficient, to be able to do this yourself.
Yeah.
Even if there's something on the floor, you want you to pick it up, you don't want anybody to help. So when I left therapy, I wasn't, anybody would do something, I did not want to let me do it.
Right.
People were willing to help me, look at me, they asked me, but they were not happy. I said, no, then later on, I read this, and I said, Jesus said, no, when I was sick, he didn't care for me. So now, when I'm sure, I don't know if anybody wants to, I said, maybe that's what the person wants, a blessing.
Yeah, and you were, don't you think you were right at the beginning that you had gotten these self-help skills and all that,
right,
where you say, no, I need to do this myself,
yeah, right.
And people with any sense know that, you know, and they'll ask, do you need me to pick that up for you? No, I don't. I've learned how to do this now.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting thought too, that when people offer to do something for you especially, sometimes you can swallow your pride and say, yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Paul, don't worry about lunch.
You don't want a blessing. You don't want a blessing.
Ah.
You know, he's going to tell you, when I was thinking, it didn't make me a suit.
Yes. Yes.
Let's shift gears a little bit to the business of self-centeredness. Make a visit to Mark chapter 10. Remember that Mark's gospel, what is it, 17 chapters long or so? A third of the gospel of Mark is the passion narrative. And so here we are already in Mark 10 on Palm Sunday. Mark chapter 10:46. Mind. Okay, Mark 10:46. So as I say, if you notice at the bottom of the column, it says the entry into Jerusalem, Palm Sunday. This is 14 miles away. They're not in Jerusalem yet, but they're on their way. They came to Jericho, the lowest inhabited point on earth, down in the Jordan Valley, city of palms. So now you have to imagine that here's Jesus on his way up to Jerusalem to suffer and die. He's not sure exactly what this all means, but he knows he's on his way into big trouble. And there's this faithful procession that now starts its way up these 14 winding miles up to the city of Jerusalem. So think about that. All the angels of heaven watching this, looking down. They came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a sizable crowd and this whole big procession on its way up to Jerusalem, Bartimaeus, a blind man, son of Timaeus, sat by the roadside begging, and on hearing that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, son of David, have pity on me. And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. This is an important parade. We're on our way up to Jerusalem, right? But he kept calling out all the more, son of David, have pity on me. And then the two most beautiful words in the New Testament, Jesus stopped. And all the angels are watching, you know, all the people in the crowd. So what? Bam, they start bumping into each other. What? What's going on? Jesus stopped. Say, so what? What? What's happening? And even though Christ knows that his hour has come, he's on his way up to Jerusalem to suffer and die for the world, the hosts of heaven looking down from the clouds, and he stops and says, what was that? I heard somebody. I heard something. And there's, oh, that was just Bartimaeus, the blind beggar. That's who I heard. There was a musical called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And the centurion, I forget his name, but he had this wonderful song that he had to sing, I am a parade. That's the way he walked That's the way, I am a parade. Jesus stopped. In the midst of all that, Jesus stopped. Am I ever so wrapped up in my projects, in my work, in my preoccupation, that I can't even hear the voice on the other side of the road asking for help and healing? Again, I can't help but use my own experience in the classroom. When a kid is not doing any homework, not studying for any tests, he's so eloquent, he's saying, help me, you know? And I don't hear the voice. And he could almost accuse me. He said, listen, I was telling you all the time that I needed help, and you didn't answer. Because I'm preoccupied with my lesson plan, preoccupied with whatever my task at hand is. Any thoughts, comments about that? Get wrapped up in my thing. And I wish Max were here, there's a psychological advantage to be able to focus. The ADD kids, they hear all the voices. No problem there. They're hearing every voice. I was talking to a kid the other day. I said, you know, you have problems focusing. And he's there like this. Justin, you have problems focusing. But
that's true. I mean, we can get caught up in our daily lives full of activities and challenges and goods and bads and whatever. And that can also challenge our prayer life. And we get so involved in our social life that sometimes we forget about our prayer life or our spiritual life and stop to pray. During the day, you give thanks and praise.
And you could even say your relationship with God.
God, yes.
You know, to give time to, and God is giving us hints all the time, trying to get into our lives.
Right.
And we're too busy.
We're too focused.
Good thought. So there's the issue of being so focused and so busy with myself that the law of love doesn't get much priority.
Someone wants to say something.
Thank you.
You were talking about being caught up in being busy, and I think it sounded like you were referring to, like, if you got caught up in your work. But I've even had the experience of being caught up in these sort of minuscule things of life. You know, after work, what am I going to do for dinner, or, you know, who are my friends, who's hanging around me and whatnot. And sometimes when you look at sort of those external things, well, for me, I realized that I wasn't really focusing on my relationship with God. I was more concerned with what's going on Friday night, you know, or which happy hour to go to with my friends rather than like, oh, maybe I should go to Bible study, maybe I should pray, because that really wasn't my thing. It was work. That was my life, and at that time, there was a part of my experience where God wasn't really in my life, even though he was throwing a headset. So, you know, sort of being over, like, engrossed in your life other than work, it's sometimes easy to get caught up in those things.
But you got lucky, because the Lord took a nice, quiet approach with you to get you here, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes people, you know, need to be, you know, like, you're in a head-on collision with your car on the parkway, and God gets your attention. You know? As chaplains in hospitals are well aware, I haven't been thinking about God at all. Now I'm thinking about hello.
Happened to Paul.
But then how do
happened to Paul on the way to Damascus. Yeah.
But then how do we reach out, you know, the rest of the people, the world, because not everybody will eventually change and go to monastery. Okay, the people out there now, in the parishes, maybe, how do you reach them, you know, to focus on them?
Oh, well, what I'm worried about today is reaching me. You know, the challenge is, how do I get myself to tune my hearing so I can hear, I'm using the metaphor, when I hear people who are in need asking for help. how it's about me, not about how do I get other people to do things, but what about me? How sensitive am I to the needs of people around me? And if I'm too intensely caught up in my thing, then that doesn't happen. Let's go to John 2. I think this is for us doers, people who like to accomplish. Beginning of chapter 2 in John. The first of Jesus' miracles. John 2, verse 1. Right. I could use a lector on this one. The wedding at Cana. Thank you.
On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana, in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the wedding. When the wine ran short, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, how does your concern affect me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servers, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for Jewish ceremonial wedding washings, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told them, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it. And when the head waiter tasted the water that had become wine, without knowing where it came from, although the servers who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves good wine first, and then when people have drunk freely, an inferior one. But you kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this as the beginning of his signs of Cana in Galilee, and so revealed his glory, and his disciples began to believe in him.
So here's the story, very early on, chapter 2 in John, that Jesus has been invited to this wedding feast. These wedding feasts would go on for a week. Biggest thing that's happened in the village in years, you know. So we've gone for a week. And he apparently came a little bit later. And so he saw, Mary sees the situation. So she goes to Jesus and says, "Quick, run down to Home Liquors and buy a couple of cases of Burgundy." But that's not what she does. She doesn't go to him with a solution. And then, when Jesus says to her, "Woman, what concern is this?" You know, in John's gospel, he's going to use that strange term, "woman." The next time he uses it, it'll be hanging on the cross. "Woman, behold your son." And we could do a whole thing on that, but we'll skip that for now. But he says, "I'm at the beginning of my ministry, if I even have one. I don't know, what are you asking me for? What am I doing here?" So Mary goes over to the servants that are standing by, and she says, "See the guy with the beard? Go over and stand right in front of him until he starts to fidget and feel guilty." She presents Jesus with the problem, not with the solution. And she essentially says, "They have no wine. Surprise me," and walks away. She leaves him the freedom to perform his first and most beautiful miracle, changing water into wine, and according to the measures there of wine, enough wine to keep them in wine for months. The abundance that shows up in the Old Testament in the Messianic days. Mastery gives orders. Intimacy says, "Surprise me." When we pray, it often sounds like a list for Santa Claus or something. I want this to happen, I want that to happen, I want this to happen. Do we ever have the courage to pray, "Lord, surprise me"? Now, of course, Jesus tells us to ask for what we want. You're supposed to do that. But there's also another side. Human beings, you know, everything's got two sides. no matter how thin you make a pancake, it's always got two sides. There's also the side, don't be afraid to ask God, please, please, I want this. Please let Aunt Emma survive and get out of the hospital. You're supposed to pray that way. But there's also the side to be able to go to the Lord with open hands.
I remember when Father John was sick. May his soul rest in peace. But he's in the hospital. And I was there. After some time, I said, Father John, I want to go. Pray, I want to go. Couldn't understand. He looked at me, he said, why not pray? Okay, I found my little prayer. I said, Lord, please, if Father John, let him come back to the monastery. Not coming here all the time. You know, Father John said, oh, what kind of prayer is this? What kind of prayer is this? Why not pray for the will of God?
And you said, yes.
Okay.
When the disciples asked Jesus, teach us how to pray, he said, pray this way, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's not a real mastery approach to things when you say, thy will be done. Teach me to accept your will. Help me to accept whatever your will is going to be. But by the way, what I'd really like is for this to happen. You got to do that. You got to leave yourself vulnerable. That's the intimacy approach. And then if God says no, well, that's all right. And in a relationship like that, you can get ticked off at God. And say, well, forget you then. That's the way you treat your friends? Then that's all right too. Okay, that's plenty of talk.